Okay, let's cut straight to it. You often hear Puerto Rico described, simply as an island.
Yeah, it's the
Yeah,
common picture, isn't it?
right. A seemingly straightforward geographical fact. But what if that description, I mean, while technically true for the main part, what if it actually obscures a much deeper, more complex reality?
Well, exactly. What if it kind of contributes to a misunderstanding of Puerto Rico's history and, well, its ongoing political struggles?
That's the core idea we're exploring today,
Yeah.
because that phrase Puerto Rico is an island, it's geographically incomplete, isn't it?
It absolutely is. It totally overlooks that the territory is, in fact, an archipelago. And our source material today, especially this really compelling article from Pasquines, that's Pasquines by William Jose Vasconcelos, makes it super clear
Clear how.
that recognizing Puerto Rico as an archipelago is way more than just a technical point. It's actually essential to understanding its history, its whole geopolitical relationship with powers like Spain and then the United States, and the actual lived experience of its people.
Absolutely. So the Pasquines article isn't just saying, hey, technically there are more islands. It's arguing that the history and the current reality of those other islands, especially Culebra, that's Culebra,
Yeah.
and VX, VAYKs, are like microcosms.
Microcosms, yeah, of the larger political dilemma facing the whole territory.
Exactly. So our mission, our goal in this deep dive is really to explore that argument. We're going to use that Pasquines piece as our main guide, but we'll also bring in details from an Associated Press article and just the context from imagining these places the sources talk about.
Right, we want to understand why. Why acknowledging these other islands, Culebra and VX, why is that so crucial to getting the full picture of Puerto Rico's political story?
Okay, so let's start with that core idea then. Puerto Rico as an archipelago.
Yeah, the technical definition is pretty important here. So the main island, which is also called Puerto Rico, that's where most of the territory's 3.3 million residents live,
Oh, it's
obviously.
the vast majority.
But the territory itself includes way more. According to the source, it's made up of over 143 distinct islands, cays, islets, and atolls.
Whoa, over 143. Okay, that's definitely an archipelago. I mean, a chain or cluster of islands, right?
Precisely. And the Pasquines article really hammers this home. While the main island has the name and the population center, from a geopolitical, a practical, even a historical view, it's vital, absolutely vital to look beyond it.
And to acknowledge the others.
Yes. And Culebra and VX get highlighted specifically because they are permanently inhabited. These aren't just, random rocks sticking out of the water.
No, they're communities, homes, people with deep roots in their own histories.
Exactly. And their history isn't just some side note. The sources make it clear these smaller islands, sometimes you hear them called the Spanish Virgin Islands historically, they've actually been pivotal.
Pivotal in how the territory evolved into its current geopolitical shape.
Yeah. Their experiences are deeply, deeply intertwined with the main island's story. And arguably, their stories really illuminate the challenges the entire archipelago has faced under, well, external rule.
Which brings us straight to that broader political context. It's like the undercurrent through all of this, isn't it?
It really is. You have residents who are American citizens. They've had that status since 1917, but crucially, they cannot vote for the U.S. president.
And they lack proportional voting representation in Congress.
Exactly. And this fundamental lack of political power, specifically at the federal level where the ultimate authority over the territory lies, that's the absolute bedrock. You have to understand that to grasp the history we're about to get into, especially with Culebra and VX.
Because it's that lack of power that sort of allowed their experiences to unfold the way they did.
Precisely. It created the conditions for what happened next.
Okay, so let's rewind. Let's go back centuries, back when this is a Spanish archipelago. Now, interestingly, the sources point out that formally, administratively, Culebra and VX weren't even included with the main island of Puerto Rico until pretty late in the game, right? Late 1800s.
Yeah, that formal administrative link came late in the Spanish colonial period. But the relationship, the connection between the main island and these eastern neighbors, that goes back centuries before Spain or America were involved. We're talking pre-colonial time.
Okay. And what do we know about that period? The sources mentioned records are limited, but.
Right, records are scarce, but what we do know from the sources is fascinating. The main island existed maybe as a kind of theocratic monarchy known by its indigenous name, Borican.
Borkin. And who lived on these islands back then before the Spanish arrived?
So the Pasquines article tells us the main island and VX were home to the Taíno people.
Okay. Taíno.
But Culebra, the island further east, was inhabited by the Carib people.
Ah, so different groups on neighboring islands. And the source adds another layer here. The Taino and the Carib, they were historically enemies.
Yes, that historical antagonism between them adds this really complex dynamic to the whole pre-colonial picture. But here's where it gets super interesting and honestly kind of foreshadows the future importance of these smaller islands, strategically speaking.
How so?
Well, think about when the Spanish arrived. They start colonizing, right? And of course, there's conflict, there's rebellion from the indigenous populations. So where did some of the Taino chiefs who were leading the rebellion on the main island, where did they try to escape to?
Let me guess. The smaller islands, mm-hmm. Culebra and Vieque.
Exactly. The source highlights that they fled to these adjacent islands to get away from the Spanish forces. Now, the Spanish eventually crushed the rebellion on the main island, and Culebra was actually abandoned for centuries after this. But that early interaction is still a really crucial detail. It shows that these small islands, right from the very beginning, played a significant role, even if temporary, in military conflict and geopolitical strategy.
They were places of refuge, maybe potential staging areas.
Or just areas outside the immediate grip of whoever controlled the main island. It establishes this pattern, you see. These smaller islands being strategically important long, long before the U.S. Navy ever showed up.
That's a really powerful connection, stretching from ancient history right up to much more recent events. Okay, so let's jump forward. Fast forward several centuries, past all that Spanish rule, to 1898, the Spanish-American War.
A huge turning point. Spain is defeated, and under the Treaty of Paris, Puerto Rico gets ceded to the United States.
And Puerto Rico, in that treaty, meant the whole package deal.
Absolutely. Critically, that cession included the entire archipelago. So with the stroke of a pen, Culebra, Vieques, all those other little islands, they become American islands.
A massive shift in sovereignty.
Huge. And it brought major political and economic changes under U.S. control. And this is where the Pasquin's article makes that central argument we mentioned earlier. With this shift, these small islands started serving as, what was the word?
Microcosms.
Microcosms, right. Microcosms of Puerto Rico's bigger, ongoing colonial situation under the U.S.
Okay, microcosms. That's a strong idea. How did that actually play out? How did the experiences on Culebra and Vieques mirror those broader challenges the whole territory faced under U.S. rule?
Well, the most prominent way, and the sources go into a lot of detail here, was through their use by the U.S. military. Even before World War II, the U.S. Navy was looking for strategic spots in the Caribbean for training exercises.
And they landed on Culebra.
They decided to start using Culebra as a gunnery and bombing practice range.
Wait, so they started doing live-fire military training on an island where people were living? And had been for a long time.
Exactly. And this wasn't just a short-term thing. This went on for many, many decades. Decades.
Wow. So the people of Culebra just had to live with that. The constant noise, the disruption, the danger, I imagine.
Absolutely. The danger of military bombs going off on or near their homes. It wasn't until the early 1970s that things really came to a head. That's when you see the start of the famous Navy Culebra protests, really kicking off around 1971.
What was the trigger then? What pushed people to that level of sustained protest?
The immediate spark was a proposal from the armed forces that was just, well, frankly, audacious. They proposed to completely buy out the entire island.
Buy out Culebra?
Yeah, forcibly relocate all the residents and basically turn the whole place into a military-only zone.
Forcible relocation. That's extreme. And I assume the people of Culebra didn't go for that.
Not at all. The wow. source highlights this rejection as the real ignition point. It sparked this significant, long struggle to end the bombings and get the Navy off their island. It was a fight for their homes, their safety, their right to just live in peace.
And they succeeded, didn't they? They managed to get the Navy out of Culebra eventually.
They did. It was a tough fight, gained a lot of attention and support, and finally resulted in the Navy stopping the gunnery and bombing practice on Culebra in 1975. A really hard-won victory.
But the Pasquin's article uses that phrase, short-lived. That sounds ominous.
It absolutely is ominous because the Navy didn't actually stop its practice operations altogether. They just consolidated them. They moved them.
Moved them where?
All that gunnery practice, all that bombing, it went straight onto the neighboring island of Vieques.
Oh, no. So Vieques basically got Culebra's problem, but maybe even worse because it was consolidated.
Pretty much. Vieques inherited the burden. So let's shift focus there because Vieques' struggle is just as crucial to this archipelago story. And it went on for much longer.
Okay, so the bombing practice moves to Vieques and continues for decades more.
Right.
after the Navy left Culebra.
Yes, many more years. The residents of VX had to endure the same kind of thing Culebra did. The constant noise of bombs, the ground shaking from shells, the military presence everywhere, and always, always that danger from live ordnance.
This has been terrifying.
Unimaginable. And the situation continued, you know, sparking protests here and there. But it wasn't until a really tragic incident in 1999 that things truly exploded into widespread, sustained protest and civil disobedience.
1999. What happened then?
A man named David Sanez Rodriguez. He was a civilian employee of the Navy, but also a resident of VIEC. He was tragically killed.
Oh.
During a bombing practice exercise, military ordnance bombs were dropped too close to the security post where he was working on the island, and he died.
Oh, that's just heartbreaking. And that awful loss of life, that became the catalyst, the turning point.
It really was. The source emphasizes that this incident sparked massive protests, acts of civil disobedience on a huge scale. People from all walks of life, on VIEC, on the main island, they were just outraged and galvanized.
And this time, it got more attention.
Crucially, yes. These efforts started attracting significant international attention. The struggle of VIEC wasn't some local issue anymore. It was suddenly on the global stage. People were watching.
So you had this sustained pressure. Local population, people on the main island, international allies. What was the outcome for VIEC?
All that combined pressure, the constant protests, the civil disobedience, the international spotlight, it finally led to the U.S. announcing it would leave VIEC. That was in 2003.
Okay, so Culebra 1975, VIEC 2003. Both endured decades as military practice grounds. Both required years of intense struggle to get the Navy out. And the Pasquin's article argues this shared experience is the perfect example, the encapsulation of the larger political problem facing Puerto Rico.
Exactly. Their fate under U.S. control, having their land, their lives subject to decisions made so far away, it really embodies that larger struggle. And it all stems from Puerto Rico's fundamental lack of political power at the federal level.
How does it show that lack of power so clearly?
Well, the source connects the dots very explicitly. Because Puerto Rico and its residents don't have voting representation in the federal government, the government deciding whether to use their homes as bombing ranges, the people on Culebra and VIEC were basically defenseless.
Defenseless legally or politically?
Both, really. They were at the mercy of policies made by officials they couldn't vote for in Congress, where they didn't have proportional representation to effectively fight for their safety, for their well-being.
And the Pasquin's article also mentions these claims of higher rates of diseases on the islands. That suggests the toll wasn't just noise and disruption, but potentially serious health consequences, too.
Yes, the source brings that up, suggesting the environmental and health impact could have been severe. It hints at possible links between the decades of military activity and higher rates of things like cancer or asthma among residents. While it doesn't dive deep into the scientific evidence, that's not in our text, including it really underscores the perceived severity. It suggests their situation was truly dire and maybe needed those extraordinary actions we saw in the protests.
Right. You mentioned extraordinary actions and civic mobilization. What did that actually look like on the ground? What did people do because they didn't have that conventional political power?
The source describes all sorts of tactics. People actually set up encampments inside the bombing range itself. Imagine that. A direct physical challenge to the military.
Wow. That takes incredible bravery.
Absolutely. There were widespread acts of civil disobedience, like boat flotillas sailing into the practice zones to disrupt training, people deliberately entering restricted areas to get arrested and draw attention. But crucially, the movement needed help from outside.
Outside VIEC and Culebra.
Yes. Not just local activists. The source highlights the involvement of international celebrities using their fame to shine a light on it. And even U.S. government officials got involved.
You mean like members of Congress from the mainland?
Exactly. The source specifically notes members of Congress from states like Illinois and New York actually traveled to VIEC and joined the protests, demanding the Navy leave.
That really shows the level of outside pressure needed, doesn't it? It suggests the normal channels, the way constituents in a state can influence things, just weren't working or weren't available.
Precisely. And what about the local government, the elected officials in Puerto Rico? Could they do anything? Could they pass a law or go to court to stop the Navy?
That's a key question.
And the Pasquin's article is very direct about this. Even when the Puerto Rican government faced huge pressure from its own people to act, ultimately, it was without recourse. Local laws didn't matter. Public opinion didn't legally matter. Even court challenges failed.
Why?
The source notes that the courts consistently upheld the Navy's federal right to use the islands for training. Federal authority trumped local concerns, local laws, everything. It just highlights that fundamental power imbalance baked into the territorial relationship.
This really does crystallize the whole issue of Puerto Rico's territorial status.
Mm-hmm.
The source uses that heading, Islands Without Control.
It fits perfectly, doesn't it? And the Pasquin's article states it plainly. Puerto Rico was powerless in these situations precisely because it's an unincorporated territory. It doesn't have the same kind of inherent sovereignty a state has to push back against the federal government acting within its borders. The feds just operate with a higher level of authority in a territory.
The source also brings up a really tough point, that for some people watching this unfold, the way the locals on Culebra and VX were treated, it seemed to reveal discriminatory attitudes, maybe tied to how the territory itself and its people were viewed.
That's a heavy point, but yeah, the source puts it out there. It suggests that maybe this prolonged disregard for the safety, the health, the wishes of these island residents who are U.S. citizens, remember, maybe it wouldn't have happened or wouldn't have gone on for so long if they lived in one of the 50 states. It hints that perhaps it reflects underlying biases linked to that unique subordinate political status.
It's a disturbing thought. And just to be clear, the Navy did leave eventually, Culebra and 75 VX in 2003, but the source stresses this wasn't because Puerto Rico forced them out legally or politically.
Correct. It came down to decisions made by the federal government. President Nixon directed the Navy out of Culebra. President Bush announced the withdrawal from VX. The power to stop it rested in Washington, not San Juan.
And adding insult to injury, the source mentions that even when agreements were made during the struggle, sometimes they were just ignored or unilaterally changed.
Yeah, that detail really underscores the power disparity. Agreements reached could apparently be disregarded or reversed by the more powerful party, leaving the local communities feeling even more vulnerable.
That vulnerability must have been immense. And the source points out another really striking thing related to this lack of control, this weird disconnect, this isolation between the conversation happening nationally on the mainland and the reality on the islands.
Yes, that's fascinating and quite troubling. The Pasquin's article mentions that on the mainland, you had groups actively opposing the Navy leaving Vieques. They were talking about geopolitical strategy or the economic hit to Navy bases elsewhere if Vieques closed.
Okay. Understandable concerns from their perspective, maybe. But the source also says some people on Vieques itself also opposed the Navy leaving.
Yes. That's such a crucial, complex detail. It highlights the incredibly difficult spot many residents were in. For some people in Vieques, the bombing range was awful. It was dangerous, disruptive. But the Navy's presence also meant jobs. It meant some level of economic stability, something known.
So for them, the Navy leaving meant economic uncertainty, fear about their livelihoods.
Exactly. So you end up with this really strange situation. Some groups on the mainland and a segment of the local population in VX both arguing against the departure, though for totally different reasons. While the vast majority of VX residents and their supporters on the main island were fighting desperately to get the military out.
It sounds incredibly fractured.
Deeply fractured. And the source describes these different groups acting almost independent and oblivious to the other. This disconnect, right? Where decisions impacting lives, safety, the environment on these islands were being debated and made without necessarily even understanding, let alone integrating, the local context, the local feelings. It's a powerful example.
An example of how decisions about Puerto Rico often get made at the national level.
Yeah, often without the proper context of what's actually happening on the ground, what people there need, what they want. The voices being directly bombed weren't necessarily the ones driving the final decision.
It really paints that picture of decisions being imposed, not made collaboratively.
Okay, let's fast forward to today. The source talks about present-day oblivion and challenges that still endure. Are the effects of being a bombing range still felt daily in Culebra and VX, even decades after the Navy left?
Oh, absolutely. The legacy isn't just history. The effects of Puerto Rico's status, and specifically for Culebra and VX, the aftermath of that long military presence, it's not abstract. It's daily life.
Also, well, there are still huge ongoing debates about the true scale of the damage, environmental damage, potential long-term health impacts, and the cleanup effort. The work needed to just make the former practice sites safe, it's immense, and it's still a major challenge.
I was really struck by that detail in the source about the sheer amount of bombing and how dangerous it still is.
It's truly sobering. The Pesquin's article notes the bombing on Culebra was so extensive that more than four decades after the Navy left in 1975, people are still getting hurt by leftover shells, unexploded ordnance.
40 years later, still dangerous.
40 years later. And on VX, that AP article we mentioned notes the cleanup of the old bombing range is expected to take another decade. That's 20 years after the Navy left and still 10 more years of cleanup projected.
It just shows the scale of the contamination. So making the island safe again is this decades-long, massive undertaking. Who's pushing for this now? Who advocates for the resources needed for cleanup for recovery?
And this brings us right back full circle to that core political issue. To this day, getting the funding, getting the cleanup prioritized for these oft-forgotten islands, as the source calls them, it often depends on convincing senators and representatives in the U.S. Congress.
Officials who Puerto Ricans can't vote for.
Exactly. They have to rely on pressure from officials they have no electoral control over to lobby the executive branch. It's this frustrating continuation of the exact same dependency, the same lack of direct political leverage that characterized the fight against the bombings in the first place. Attention, resources, they still depend on the priorities and, frankly, the goodwill of federal officials they didn't elect.
And beyond just the physical cleanup, what about the economic and social side? How are the islands doing after the military, which was such a huge presence, pulled out?
That's another major challenge, the source points out. For decades, their economies, their infrastructure, in many ways, they developed around the military base. So when the Navy left, both Culebra and VX were left sort of reeling, trying to figure out what comes next. Yeah, they face huge hurdles in things like building sustainable tourism, supporting local businesses, maintaining their ecosystems, many of which were obviously impacted by all the military activity. It's been a really tough economic and social transition.
That Associated Press article painted a pretty bleak picture of Vieques today, even with tourism picking up somewhat.
It really did. The AP piece goes into some of those persistent challenges. It quotes the mayor, Victor Emmerich, that's E-H-H me, Reek highlighting several critical issues, like the fact that the island, with around 10,000 people, still has no hospital.
Still no hospital, after all the concerns raised about health impacts from the bombing.
Still no hospital capable of treating serious illnesses, including things like cancer and asthma that many residents believe are linked, at least partly, to that military legacy. It's quite shocking, really.
It absolutely is.
The AP article also mentions a really high unemployment rate, nearly 20%, and they're still heavily dependent on this unreliable, crippled ferry system for their essential link to the main island, for everything from supplies to medical care to just getting around.
That quote from Mayor Emmerich in the AP piece really stuck with me. It speaks volumes about that feeling of being forgotten. He said, "Time passed and everyone forgot about us. None of the development that we expected has occurred."
Oof. Yeah, that quote just captures that lingering sense of neglect, doesn't it? The feeling that after all the protests, all the attention, the islands were basically left on their own without enough support for the long-term recovery and development they desperately needed after decades of military use.
And the source material gives one more really stark example of that perceived neglect, especially for federal authorities, after a major crisis hit.
You mean after Hurricane Maria?
Exactly.
Yeah, the source notes this incredible, devastating fact. More than 8 months after Hurricane Maria ripped through Puerto Rico in 2017, Culebra and VX were the only two municipalities in the entire territory still completely dependent on generators for power.
8 months without being reconnected to the grid. That just seems almost unbelievable, that level of isolation, that apparent lack of priority.
It's a powerful recent example, isn't it? It shows how these islands, despite their history, despite the spotlight they had during protests, can still end up at the absolute bottom of the list when it comes to recovery, when it comes to basic services. It just reinforces that sense of being overlooked and highlights the deep vulnerability tied to their status within the archipelago and within the larger territory.
Okay, we've covered so much history here, from ancient Taino refugees, Spanish administrative details, decades under U.S. military control, those intense protest movements, and these ongoing present-day challenges. Let's circle back to where we started. Puerto Rico is not an island. Why does getting that right, recognizing it as an archipelago, understanding the specific stories of Culebra and VX, why does it matter so much?
Well, the Pesquin's article argues that this recognition is really essential context. It helps you see the power dynamics at play. Dynamics with a federal government that, as the source puts it, got accustomed and empowered to exert its will in Puerto Rico, with little to no regard for local sentiment during that whole military occupation period. The experiences of Culebra and Vieck are just prime, unavoidable examples of that dynamic in action.
So, calling Puerto Rico just an island isn't merely a geographical slip-up. It actually has deeper implications. It affects how we understand the place.
Precisely. The source argues that when you dismiss or overlook the existence, the importance of the other islands, even just casually, by calling the whole territory an island, you do more than just misrepresent a technical fact. You actually further propel an oversimplified and reductionist idea of the territory and its really complex conditions.
Even if people don't mean to do that, even if it's unintentional.
Exactly. The source suggests these effects might be unintentional, but nonetheless real. The language we use, it shapes how we think, how we perceive things, and reducing Puerto Rico to just one single island, it can implicitly erase the very real, very impactful histories and the ongoing struggles of places like Culebra and Vieques.
And if you erase their story, you simplify the bigger picture.
You oversimplify the larger narrative of the archipelago's political status, its history of these power imbalances, and the very real challenges its people face. It's like trying to understand a family by only talking about one sibling.
That's a great analogy. So the history, the present reality of Culebra and Vieques, they aren't just footnotes. They're actually central to understanding the whole story of Puerto Rico.
That is exactly the argument. As the Pasquin's article concludes so powerfully, you know, from being these ancient military points for indigenous groups, then for the Spanish, and then becoming these potent symbols of the larger political dilemma under U.S. control, Culebra and Vieques' contributions, their long-suffering, their current problems, they demand to be recognized.
And refusing to let their story be forgotten, refusing to simplify it, that reinforces the main point.
Absolutely. Because of this incredibly rich, complex history, a history defined by struggle against outside control, by political isolation, legal isolation, media isolation, sometimes the source's argument really stands strong. Puerto Rico is not just an island. It is an archipelago. And its component parts, especially Culebra and Vieques, tell this powerful, essential, and often painful story about its past, its present, and the ongoing challenges that continue to shape the lives of all its citizens.
So here's something to think about based only on what we've discussed from these sources. What does the specific history of Culebra and Vieques truly reveal about the broader dynamics of power, of sovereignty, and maybe most importantly, the actual lived experience of being a citizen in an unincorporated territory? It's certainly a question worth reflecting on.